Welcome to The Inquiry with me, Tanya Beckett. One question, four expert witnesses, and an answer. The world is in the middle of an energy crisis. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has led to an energy price shock, the likes of which has not been seen since the 1970s. Many countries have rushed to produce more coal and oil to bring down prices, and this has contributed to existing worries about damage to the environment and climate change. But there's also been a renewed focus on how countries can generate more power from sustainable sources and rely less on fossil fuels and the international market. So this week on The Inquiry, we're asking, can a country live on renewable energy alone?
Part 1. What is renewable energy?
Renewable energy is one that has an everlasting source, and specifically in our case, the sun provides us a never-ending supply of energy. And so when the sun's energy reaches the earth, it can directly convert to electricity or to heat, and it can also warm the earth, which drives the wind. So renewable energy is energy that is ever replenished and is sustainable.
Our first witness is a world-renowned expert in solar cells and is also working out how to convert the most populous US state to renewable energy without the risk of blackouts.
I'm Sarah Kurtz. I'm a professor at the University of California, Merced.
Solar and wind energy make up a tenth of all of the electricity generated around the world. But we currently get most of our renewable energy globally from hydropower, or the generation of electricity through the flow of water. We've been generating electricity from windmills, water mills, and solar panels for nearly a century and a half. What's changed in recent years is that the technology has become more efficient and cheaper.
The cost per square meter of a panel is about the same as if you hired somebody to come in and paint your house. So it's really amazing how much the costs have come down. The efficiencies have gone up. The rate of change of the evolution of the technology is actually accelerating.
Scientific progress has led to solar and wind power growing in capacity and making up an increasingly large part of the energy mix. But we still face limitations.
When the sun sets, we need to figure out how to use the sun's energy to keep the lights on during the night. And so we need to have a system that can be automated to identify when we're going to have renewable electricity and when we need to use storage to be able to provide electricity in the gaps.
Storage comes, of course, in the form of batteries. Now, this is one thing when we're talking about powering cars or heating, but we've seen that high power prices have left many manufacturers finding it hard to keep going. And this needs to be factored into our thinking. But only once a significant proportion of our electricity comes from renewable sources.
We don't need to have storage until we get up into the range of something like 15 to 25%. Our ability to deliver the large scale storage is not yet adequate. But it is, I think, currently one of the main bottlenecks, although we could do much more with solar and wind than what we're doing now without storage.
Battery capacity isn't our only challenge when it comes to renewable electricity. Solar panels, hydro plants, and wind turbines need to be situated in locations that allow them to work best. Fossil fuels, by contrast, can be burned to produce energy close to where it's needed.
With a car that you fill with gasoline, you can fill it at a rate that is really remarkable in terms of the rate of the energy transfer. But if you look at putting out a solar panel, the rate at which it collects the sunshine is much slower.
Also, if we want to rely more on renewable energy, we need to build more capacity to produce it. Production capacity is currently forecast to increase by over 60% between 2020 and 2026 globally. But when we're working out how much electricity we need, we have to bear in mind that as the global population grows, so does demand for energy.
Getting the infrastructure developed can take some time. It took us decades to develop our current grid that has put wires all across both cities and countryside. And to be able to develop renewable energy to the same level, we should expect will take decades to put in that infrastructure. And so it's just a challenge of how quickly we can move.
Building renewable electricity generation is cheaper than coal and gas plants, but the money still needs to be made available to make it happen.
The technology is there to do it, but investing in that infrastructure is difficult, both for permitting and policy reasons, and also it can be difficult to identify who will pay for an expansion like that when it's something that the whole community uses.
There is a country, though, whose government made a very large call on all of this a long time ago, and whose electricity is almost all from renewable sources. That country is Iceland.
Part 2. Fire and ice.
If you invest in the right infrastructure, a renewable one, a one that supports a green future, the benefits is something that people do not reap the day after or in the years after. The infrastructure can support generations for decades.
Iceland is often referred to as the land of fire and ice. An island of just 250,000 people that can be circumnavigated in less than a day, this small Nordic nation is home to some of the world's most unique geology. As its name suggests, a tenth of Iceland is covered in glaciers. But it's also home to scores of volcanic mountains. This is because the country sits on the border of two tectonic plates, or a split in the Earth's crust. So heat can make its way up to the surface from closer to the Earth's core. The result is not just a mass of volcanoes, but also hundreds of hot springs.
My name is Halla Hrundlóadóttir. I'm the Director General of Iceland's National Energy Authority, and I come from Iceland.
Halla explains how in 1908, over a century ago, Icelanders began to harvest the heat from hot springs to warm their homes.
There was a farmer that found a way to connect his house to a neighboring hot spring. Then few others did the same. And from there, municipalities scaled the effort. The first drilling was done in Reykjavik in 1928. And then it scaled from only a few buildings like our hospital and one of our main schools being heated with geothermal into a national policy that really helped us make the transition that we have today.
An energy solution that had begun with one individual over 100 years ago was given financial impetus in the 1960s from the capital, Reykjavik.
A brilliant thing that the government did around that time was that it established what we call the Iceland Energy Fund. It was a fund that gave municipalities money to drill for geothermal. And if a drilling was successful, the funding turned into a long-term loan. But if it was unsuccessful, a part of the cost was cancelled. So it helped the municipalities to take the risk, knowing that the full cost of the drilling would not end up on their shoulders if the drilling was not successful.
Today, 9 out of 10 houses in Iceland are heated with geothermal energy.
You can imagine here in Iceland, even though it's not always stormy, we often live up to our name, having ice-cold winters with unpredictable weather. But thanks to geothermal, the hot water flows through pipes into our houses, and we heat the houses with the geothermal energy, which keeps our life standard and living conditions extremely good, despite those cold winter days. So geothermal is a big part of Iceland's quality of life, if you will.
The energy stored in Iceland's hot springs can also be used in other ways to power other parts of the economy.
The exciting part of geothermal is that you can also use it for electricity production. Food production has a lot of potential when it comes to geothermal, because you can use it to in greenhouses. And thanks to geothermal and our renewables in general, we are able to produce a lot of our vegetables locally all year round.
Almost all of Iceland's electricity comes from geothermal sources. But when it comes to fuel for transport, Halla says the country still has some way to go to break free from fossil fuels.
Actually, over 50% of newly registered cars are purely electric. And in the case of the fishing fleet, the government has been investing in retrofitting ships. And in aviation, our main carrier has been focusing on electrifying our internal flights completely within the next decade.
Aside from paying substantially less for energy, Iceland also benefits from cleaner air than many of its European neighbours.
If you look at pictures from the early 1900s from Reykjavik, you can see this thick black cloud looming over the city. And then if you look at pictures from the same angle after the geothermal district heating systems were built, you can see clear blue skies. So the impact on air quality has been enormous. So it was actually already in 1938 something that was on the front page of one of our largest newspaper. Vote for geothermal, it said. Vote for the clean air.
Iceland is blessed with rather unique geology that helped propel it along the path to green energy. But with the right approach, could other countries follow Iceland's example?
Part 3. The energy mix.
Our third expert witness is one of the authors of a major report on renewable energy published in 2018, stating that in 20 years, the world could generate all of its energy from renewable sources, two-thirds of which would come from solar panels.
My name is Christian Breyer. I'm professor for solar economy at Lund University in Finland.
Christian emphasizes that Iceland is unusually blessed when it comes to generating renewable energy. But the rest of the world still has much to learn from its extraordinary journey.
Oh, Iceland is a great example of what can be achieved with renewable energy. However, it has very special conditions because it's a rather large island with a rather small population. The success with renewable energy is to make the best of the existing local resources, which in most regions in the world will be always solar energy, and in quite many other regions in the world it's wind energy, and in many parts in the world it's still hydropower, and if geothermal energy is available, it's great.
And in order to be successful in breaking away from fossil fuels, we just need to get the mix of green energy exactly right.
In the summer in the Northern Hemisphere, solar energy is really good during daytime. Wind energy is excellent in the winter half year, very often 24/7. And then we have to combine both resources. And then, of course, with the renewable energy, we need flexibility in the system, flexibility in demand and storage.
Christian cites the example of India, the world's third largest emitter of greenhouse gases, but where the supply of renewable energy is growing faster than in any other major economy. This is helped by powerful sunshine for much of the year, but India is also subjected to prolonged periods of rain.
So there might be a kind of a partial shortage of solar energy in some parts of India during the monsoon, but only half of the country is affected, so the other half would still have the full sunshine. Then with better grid capacities, one could send more solar electricity from the not monsoon-affected regions to the other regions during that time.
Aside from transferring electricity from one location to another, as we heard earlier, an alternative solution is to have enough battery capacity to store it locally when the sun isn't shining. Christian says, as well as investing in more batteries, India can also use the existing batteries it has in the nation's growing number of electric cars.
80% of all batteries we need as a society, we will need in vehicles, typically rolling on the road. So for cars, for trucks, for buses. So there we will need most of the batteries. And they're very valuable because they can indirectly balance the electricity generation. We call that smart charging, smart EV charging.
Users can also be incentivized to consume or store energy when it's plentiful and not when it's in short supply. But in many cases, even without storage, renewable energy can prove transformational, particularly in cases where it may be the only source of power available. One example of this is Yemen, a country on the southern end of the Arabian Peninsula whose power grid has been damaged by years of conflict and has one of the highest poverty rates in the world. Here, solar panels have helped many schools, hospitals, and homes to keep going.
They have a solar system, they have a battery, and with that they get a minimum electricity supply for all their needs. And they had only to once manage to get this system, and now it runs for years. So this is just an example that even in a very unstable environment, renewables might be still the best stable solution.
If a country in which millions of people struggle to feed themselves has been able to benefit from renewable energy, how might green power change not just the environment, but the whole of geopolitics?
Part 4. Green Giants.
Australia produces a third of its electricity from renewable sources. It's a country tailor-made for clean energy, with more sunshine than any other continent, and a long coastline ideal for offshore wind farms. So, from where our fourth expert witness joins us, the outlook for renewable energy looks decidedly optimistic.
Tim Buckley, Director, Climate Energy Finance in Sydney.
Tim predicts that although the cost of energy has recently soared, the rise in renewable energy means that in the long term, it will plummet.
We've never seen this sort of level of price inflation, and so there is a clear economic and political imperative to decarbonise, to invest. I'm predicting the electricity price, the wholesale price of electricity, is going to drop by upwards of 50, 60, 70% over the coming decade.
Part of the reason for Tim's optimism on energy prices is something we heard about in part three. As more Australians buy electric cars, their batteries will be able to store any renewable electricity that they don't use immediately.
When you're looking at 20 million batteries on wheels, that will play a huge function in terms of absorbing excess generation. Every day when it's sunny in Australia, the price of electricity will probably be negative, and so you'll be able to charge your car free if it's plugged in. But then, obviously, predictably, the sun goes down at 6 o'clock at night, demand goes up as everyone goes home, and I think those electric vehicles are going to play a key role there. So it is the convergence of transport, power, and industry that makes this a rather complex and messy transition.
If this is the future for Australia, then many other nations surely will find themselves on a similar path, producing a mix of solar, wind, and hydropower on their own soil. So this brings us to another question. Energy has played a role in many international conflicts, including the war in Ukraine. Sometimes it's part of the reason for the conflict, and sometimes it's weaponized and is therefore a consequence. I asked Tim if nations produce more of their own power, then could this lead to a profound change in geopolitics?
Almost every country in the last 100 years has been ruled by energy security pressures. Obviously, the wider European market is getting a very rude wake-up call as to the risks of energy security, reliance on other countries' benevolence in supplying your core infrastructure. And so you are going to see a massive shift in the geopolitics and the flows of energy and the types of energy that are used.
How will this pan out then between countries? Will there be energy superpowers, or will more countries simply be self-sufficient?
we are going to see a massive global realignment. And one of the wonderful things about renewable energy is it encourages countries to be self-sufficient so long as they have strong solar radiation and good wind resources. So we're actually going to see improved energy security for a number of countries, Australia being one of the major beneficiaries, but countries like China and India, America will all increase their self-sufficiency of energy. So it's going to improve the geopolitical issues relating to global energy trade for some countries.
So what regions of the world do you think will struggle to make the transition to renewable energy?
Japan and Korea have been in difficult positions for decades. They're very large, heavily industrialized economies, very dependent on imported fossil fuels, but neither country has very good solar radiation. They don't have a lot of land onshore for wind, and they've got high population densities. So it does mean that they are challenged. So they'll be some of the harder to decarbonize economies, and they are going to be constrained by their continued use of fossil fuels.
So now we return to our question. Can a country live on renewable energy alone? The short answer is yes, it can. Some smaller nations now get nearly all of their energy from renewable power, Costa Rica, New Zealand, Norway, and Iceland being four of them. And there are several large countries, China, Australia, and India, making huge strides. The question of transporting electricity from one country to another via so-called interconnectors is in many cases a task fraught with difficulties. But there have been some successes. In 2021, the largest undersea cable in the world began transporting renewable electricity between Norway and Britain. It allows excess renewable power to flow from one country to another, depending on which nation has produced more than it needs. Countries, though, which are geographically or politically isolated and don't have good conditions for producing renewable energy, are likely to find international collaboration a struggle. But the largest stumbling block is unquestionably the building of renewable energy capacity. A final word from our second expert witness.
And if we don't use the energy crisis in Europe now to invest in the right infrastructure that supports the green transition, we have lost an opportunity, and we will be living with an infrastructure that does not support the climate goals, not for the next few years, but for the decades to come.
This episode of The Inquiry was presented by me, Tanya Beckett. The producer was Ravi Naik. The researcher was Anushka Mutanda Doherty. The studio mix was by Richard Hannaford. And the editor is Tara McDermott.
Hi, I'm Kalki Kekla, Bollywood actor and host of My Indian Life, the podcast that explores the lives of young adults in 21st century India.
Okay, this is where I belong.
And we are back for season 3.
And what I saw was obviously beyond and blew my mind.
I'm meeting more remarkable people from every corner of India as they reveal their unique personal stories and share how they navigate modern life.
It's really important for us indigenous communities to stay connected with our roots.
I can't be special that I'm only having these ups and downs every day with my body.
I felt like super motivated to do something for the country.
That's Kalki Presents My Indian Life from the BBC World Service. Just search for My Indian Life wherever you found this podcast.